This is a Historic England podcast, sponsored by Ecclesiastical Insurance Group.
Hello, I'm Dr. Susanna Lipscomb, and you're listening to Irreplaceable, a history of England in 100 places. In this series, we explore the 100 places that help tell the story of England. If you're enjoying the series, don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. And if you're listening on iTunes, please rate this podcast and leave a very nice review. Today, we have just three more locations left to explore in the Lost and Destruction category, which is judged by Professor Mary Beard. The category has been about exploring the 10 most striking examples of places that have been lost or destroyed, or those that have been witness to loss and destruction. The three places we'll be looking at today, with the help of my studio guests, historian Dan Cruikshank and Historic England's Emily G, take us into some recent and painful events. These places have been the site of terrible tragedies. For better or worse, they have shaped us as a nation. They've taught us how to confront the past and make progress from what we've learned. We begin with the wreck of the SS Mendi, a steamship built in 1905 and lost at sea 21 kilometres off the Isle of Wight in 1917. Our category judge, Mary Beard, said that this point out at sea is important because of the then unseen nature of the lives that were lost in the tragic event which occurred here. So what happened?
Well, the Mendi was a Liverpool steamship which had been brought into wartime service by the British government in 1916. And she was carrying 823 South African servicemen to Europe from Cape Town. The First World War had brought a huge labour gap, and it was really important to bring in troops from around the empire. Subjects were essentially drafted in to assist in a wide range of roles on the front line. And the Mendi was bound from Cape Town, and she was heading to France on the Western Front, and disaster struck on the 21st. Of February in 1917.
Was she shot down? Was it the U-boat accident?
No, and of course that was the biggest threat, but it wasn't the case. It was fog, and it was a devastating accident, really. The Mendi slowed down to cross the channel, and another steamer, twice its size, the Darrow, plunged into the side of the Mendi, and we know it had cut the hull directly in half. And we found later that the Darrow had been travelling much too fast and hadn't been using fog signals correctly. And really sadly, the ship also offered no assistance, and the lifeboats had been made unusable by the hit, and hundreds of crew and servicemen died.
Hundreds of lives were lost then.
Yes, hundreds. And these were men from the South African Native Labour Corps. There were 618 black South Africans who were killed, and many of them had never seen the sea before. There were also 33 crew, and a number of white officers and military personnel were also killed. The ship sank in just 25 minutes. It was really devastating. And we know from in South Africa, oral traditions, there's a really strong sense of community story about this devastating moment, and it recounts the story. It's really quite remarkable and deeply emotional. But the Reverend Isaac Wachupe Dioba, who was on board the ship at the time, and amazingly, he came and addressed these men who knew that they were about to die. And he sought to calm them and to fortify them at this devastating moment. And we know that he said some really powerful words. He said, "Be quiet and calm, my countrymen. You are going to die, but that is what you came to do, and we die like brothers. We are the sons of Africa." And amazingly, he led them in a barefoot dance, a death drill, and we know that they were singing and drumming their feet on the decks of the ship together in a great sense of sort of solidarity as she went down.
Because they could not swim, and the lifeboats had been destroyed, and that's why they were in this terrible situation.
Some men were saved.
Yes.
Another ship came. It wasn't Madaro that rescued survivors, and another ship was there and took some of them away, and there were some survivors.
Yes.
And of course, it led to long court cases.
I don't know enough about the story, but it's presumed that there's a charge that there was some racial aspect of the rescue not being effective or timely. I mean, this is brutal and horrible to contemplate, but presumably this is part of the story which you have to face up to. I mean, how was that taken at the time? Seriously, was that charge taken seriously?
Well, the reason that Madaro hadn't helped was never fully explained. There was plenty of room on the ship to have rescued survivors, and the ship itself sustained comparatively little damage. It was much, much bigger. And it was the HMS Brisk that actually carried those few survivors to safety. The captain, the Daro. Some say he lost his nerve. Mm. Others, as you say, there was a charge that it was a sort of racially charged response at the time. And it's, of course, we just don't know. We can speculate about the reasons behind it. But we know that he was found to have, he was held to account for a short period of time, lost his license for having failed to stop properly in the mist. But there was nothing really to reflect the extraordinary, devastating loss of life.
I suppose one thing is to see how this was commemorated at the time, how it was explained at the time, because there are memorials, South Africa and here. I mean, how is it actually explained?
I mean, yes, that was one of the things that strikes me as well, is that we know about the Mary Rose nearly 500 years after that sank. But, I mean, this is little known, isn't it? The Mendi, I mean, why don't we know more about this? Why has it been forgotten?
Well, the tragedy is well known in South Africa. The story of the loss has been passed down from generation to generation. The black community obviously has a deep sense of loss and memory of this event. And during the years of apartheid, the ship, in a way, became a symbol of the injustice faced by black South Africans. But as you say, the story hasn't been well known in England. But in the last few years, there has been a great sort of awakening leading up to the centenary of it. And there is much greater discussion. Historic England has produced some really wonderful sort of curriculum guides for school children. And there is a sort of act of memory now. The South African Prime Minister at the time, he thanks the Labour Corps for their loyalty to Flag and King. But none of the South African Native Labour Corps were actually commemorated with medals at the time, although the white officers were.
Oh, is there a satisfactory memorial? If not, one should be made immediately, shouldn't it? There are memorials on the South Coast, I believe.
There are a few ways in which it's remembered. In 2003, the Mendi gave its name to South Africa's highest award for courage, which is the Order of the Mendi Decoration for Bravery, and it's bestowed by the president on the country's citizens. There is also a interpretation plaque on the South Coast, a point at which one can stand and look out to where the scene of the wreck was. The wreck was discovered in 1974 and known to be the Mendi, and some items were taken from it and brought up. So the ship still sits there, and the Ministry of Defence has protected it, the wreck, but it's designated as a protected place under the protection of the Military Remains Act in 1986. So it's a military maritime grave.
Well, this is a really, I mean, shocking story, but it reminds us of the very important role played by people across the empire, both in combatant and non-combatant roles in the war, but also that this loss can be passed over in such a way. So I think it's extremely important that the location and its loss is recognised and remembered. I'm very glad it's part of this list.
And shortly after the disaster, some of the bodies were washed ashore, and a few of the men are buried in England. I think 12 of them are buried here. One is buried in France, and there is a memorial in Holland. And a recent book was published. There is a wealth of information in published forms to try and capture some of this sad and important moment in history.
So it is possible to find out more about this, and maybe we can look into ways that they can be commemorated more. We move now to our ninth location, which also has a shocking story to tell. This episode is all full of difficult things, I'm afraid. The Neepsend district in Sheffield is where the River Don surges through, but it's this now quite industrial area of the city. It's overlooked by a well-known Sheffield landmark, the Neepsend Gasworks, which opened in 1852. The gas holder here is no longer operates, but it stores North Sea gas, and its foot sits location number 9 on Mary Beard's list, the Farfield Inn, which was once known as the Owl. Now, this is a rather humble-looking little building. It looks forgotten, but it's Grade 2 listed, which indicates its significance. So what's special about this place?
Well, the reason this inn features in this category is because it was witness to one of the biggest man-made disasters in English history, which has largely been forgotten. It was in 1864, on March the 11th, when the Dale Dyke Dam burst and 650 million gallons of water inundated the Loxley and Don valleys of Sheffield and killed at least 250 people.
It's known, isn't it, as the Great Flood of Sheffield. But what caused it? Do we know?
Yes, well, the Sheffield Waterworks Company had constructed and nearly finished the first of several dams they planned in the area in 1864. And the idea was that several reservoirs would be created as part of this. The dam was full and the embankment was just sort of getting its finishing touches on it. And on the way home one night, one of the local workers noticed a crack. The chief engineer was summoned and thought it was just a surface crack only. Nevertheless, they worked through the night to try and drain a bit of the water because it was a very wet night and there was weather coming. But it was in vain, because shortly afterwards, part of the dam collapsed, and that's what released these millions of gallons of water through the valley down towards Sheffield, where hundreds of people were asleep in their homes.
That's extraordinary, because it would have done damage, such damage, so quickly, wouldn't it? I mean, if you think about that sort of volume of water, 250 people at least, you say, died.
That's right. 400 houses washed away, 20 bridges. But the inn survived, built in the mid-18th century, miraculously, with the landlady. And I mean, what a weird story this is.
It is. I mean, so yes, the inn, which was built 1752 or 53, miraculously stood. And we've got, there's actually a picture of the three-storey stone building standing stoically looking over the destruction of the in the wake of the flood.
But presumably it was an inquiry, and presumably this is a private water company, and they presumably cut corners or in location or something. I mean, there must have been lots of lessons learned and applied. That the world must have changed in this country after this.
Yeah, well, there was an inquest after the event. And at the time, there were all sorts of theories as to why it had collapsed. But it largely pointed to poor design and workmanship on behalf of the company. And I think generally the others were meant to be, were really well built. So it just seemed to be an issue with this particular dam.
I mean, in fact, that's what Mary Beard, our judge, said about it. She said the lasting reform and assessment of corporate responsibility was an inevitable result of this tragedy. That actually it's from examples like this that one learns. I mean, terrible examples.
It's so interesting because you've got to dovetail this into the railway, private railway companies and the famous bridge collapses of this period, you know. Again, often poor design or skimpy execution or poor material. So it's all part of that world, isn't it? The Victorian world of private companies rushing ahead for profits, but they would cut corners.
And there was massive, as you might expect, public interest around it at the time. Newspapers were asking all sorts of questions of accountability and organising a public response to the destruction. So it, you know, obviously it really captured the public imagination about accountability of major public companies.
I know Sheffield very well and love it. I've worked up there, but I haven't been to the site. What's on the site now?
Well, there is a bridge now. Of course, the original bridge was lost at the time. But, I mean, yes, and actually also the other point I wanted to note is that this is still, of course, very much a contemporary debate about how you regulate public communities, how you make sure this doesn't happen again. Yeah, I mean, this is very topical, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
So the uncomfortable observation to make here is that although there were many accounts of blame, no single body or organisation was held accountable for the disaster and its impact on public life.
And therefore no compensation was paid to the families of the 400 or so?
Not that I know of.
Gosh. It was another world, wasn't it? A ruthless, thick Victorian world of commerce and thrustingness, but mistakes took place.
The pub reminding you of
Our 10th and final location in the loss and destruction category, selected by Professor Mary Beard, is the Hillsborough Football Stadium in Sheffield, nominated by you. In her words, she says, "This place is a powerful symbol of human tenacity in the pursuit of justice after a terrible loss of life." As you probably all know, the Hillsborough disaster occurred on the 15th of April 1989 during the 1988-89 FA Cup semi-final game between Liverpool and Nottingham Forest. Shortly before kick-off, in an attempt to ease overcrowding outside the entrance turnstiles, the police match commander ordered exit gate C to be opened, leading to a rush of supporters in the already overcrowded standing-only central pens allocated to Liverpool supporters. This decision resulted in the worst sporting disaster in British history, causing the deaths of 96 Liverpool football fans and leaving 766 people with both physical and mental injuries. Following a campaign for justice by various groups and individuals, hard fought for years, in 2016 a coroner's inquest ruled that the supporters were unlawfully killed. Crucially, the inquest concluded that the behaviour of the supporters themselves was not to blame for the disaster. And the campaign for justice in the aftermath of the tragedy continues in the hope that the families of those who lost their lives can find some resolution and peace. Let's hear more.
Professor Phil Scraton, I'm professor in the School of Law at Queen's University, Belfast. In the immediate aftermath of Hillsborough, it was obvious to me that there needed to be an independent form of investigation. The inquest verdict was accidental death, and what we were able to demonstrate from our research that far from it being an accident, Hillsborough was the product of deep institutionalised negligence that had occurred over many years, both in terms of the condition of the stadium, but also in the way the stadium was policed, the way entry and egress was conducted into and from the stadium, and also a general view that was held by the authorities that they were dealing with fans who would be troublesome as opposed to focusing on safety. So fans were penned in, both to the side and to the front with high fences, spiked fences. Very limited potential for getting out of those pens if there was a disaster. And the access to the two central pens, where people died at Hillsborough, was down a 1-in-6 gradient tunnel, which was illegal. In opening that exit gate, but not sealing off the tunnel, it meant that fans, not familiar with the ground, went down this 1-in-6 gradient tunnel into the backs of already full pens. They couldn't come back up. The fans at the front couldn't get out. So a crush evolved, which led to the breaking of a safety barrier at the front, where the fans were piled high, and that's where they died. The way in which that was immediately reported was that Liverpool fans had rushed the stadium, that they'd gone in, they'd caused the deaths of their fellow fans. And in actual fact, it was then published that they were drunk, that they were out of control, that they were violent, and that many hadn't got tickets. And this fitted a narrative that was well established by this time around crowd violence and football-related hooliganism. That was the lens through which the public inquiries began to view Hillsborough. The decision was taken by the jury that the deaths were accidental. I think that then set a tone all the way through the further investigations, the appeals. At every level, we came back to the same issue. And it was in 2009 when Andy Burnham made a pledge in a packed stadium, over 30,000 at Anfield, and he made a commitment that evening to a new investigation. And in fact, the Hillsborough Independent Panel was set up. I headed the research on the Hillsborough Independent Panel. We were able to demonstrate that the inquests had failed, that even Lord Justice Taylor's report had failed, that all of the previous processes had failed to demonstrate the truth of Hillsborough. We had 153 clear findings. We exonerated the fans, and we laid the responsibility at the doors of all the institutions involved. And as a consequence of that, the new inquests were then ordered. The previous inquest verdicts of accidental death were quashed. A full Independent Police Complaints Commission inquiry began, which is still ongoing after all these years, as did a criminal investigation, which has led to the prosecution of six people involved with Hillsborough. I was walking through Liverpool the day after the report came out, and a guy came running towards me, and he threw his arms around me, and he just said, "I'm a survivor from Hillsborough, and today is the first day I could walk through the city with my head held high." The city had been vilified, its people had been vilified, and let's remember that the inquest verdicts were unlawfully killed, that all 96 who died had been killed unlawfully. It changed overnight people's perceptions and understanding. It didn't give me any pleasure to say "I told you so," because I'd witnessed the suffering and premature death of so many family members, so many survivors who'd gone through hell at Hillsborough and then had lived hell afterwards. It is so important not to see Hillsborough as a football tragedy, as a soccer tragedy, but to see it as a moment in our lives when we witnessed on a large scale the deaths of people who were out enjoying themselves.
The stadium witnessed a terrible event in our collective history, and it's an interesting decision that rather than demolishing it, the stadium has continued to be used. What do you think about that?
In many ways, the continued use of the building as a football stadium sort of stands as a kind of living memorial, doesn't it? As a reminder of sport and how that brings communities together often and unites us as a people, as a country. And the idea that there's a memorial to those who died watching a game that they deeply love, supporting teams they deeply loved. And here they are, sort of, others continuing to watch and enjoy the game in that very place. And I think there's something really important about that.
And of course, what was characterised by all the years of denials by the various authorities and the sordidness of that and the the human sort of the sadness of the actions that have taken place to get to this resolution. What can you say? But this is—it is not unusual for buildings to survive. The building itself was not at fault, but the way it was used and managed on that day was the fault. I think we often live with buildings that have been host to disasters, and the buildings go on. I mean, that's okay. But I say it's such a sadly depressing tale of the incompetence and the cover-ups. And the truth has come out in the end, but there are many attempts to hide that truth, weren't there?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes I guess, you know, it shows the sort of power of place, really. The idea that our memory of something ghastly is so steeped within the wall, sometimes the only thing to do, really, is to take it away and create something else there. And it's useful, I suppose, to think about what's happening with the Grenfell Tower site now, and the decision to create a community-led memorial on that site is a really powerful thing.
And with Hillsborough, of course, it's a symbol of more, the football stadium, a symbol of more than just the tragedy, I suppose. It's a symbol of the fight for justice since, isn't it, now? And so speaks to the kind of how we engage with power and authority and all of that legacy.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, it signifies the power of a collective people's voice in challenging and checking institutions, sort of like we spoke about with the previous site in Sheffield, and the idea of holding public bodies accountable and reminding of the power of the people to keep reinforcing the importance of that message.
There was an awful arrogance, aided and abetted by the press at the time, to manipulate what had happened to make it the response, you know, the blame the fans. This was so serious, wasn't it? All of that story.
And it reminds us, in fact, of those that there are ongoing and unresolved cases for families, even 29 years after the event. Well, that's where we finish the loss and destruction category for A History of England in 100 Places. Before we go, though, we asked Mary Beard if she thought there was anywhere in England that deserved a special mention in this category. For this, she picked the Lady Chapel at Ely Cathedral in Cambridgeshire. She describes what remains of this medieval chapel as a wonderful aesthetic space in its own right. You can visit this 100-foot-long Gothic chapel and see hints of the statues, sculptures and beautiful reliefs that would have adorned this chapel before they were removed and defaced after the Reformation. A poignant spot to consider art, architecture and faith in the face of change. Mary also noted how destruction of this kind can leave us with a monumental space such as this that still has great significance today. So on that note, let's recap the 10 loss and destruction locations, which were Must Farm Bronze Age Settlement in Peterborough, Whitby Abbey in Yorkshire, Greyfriars Monastery in Suffolk, the Mary Rose in Portsmouth, the Monument in London, the Crystal Palace in South London, the Euston Arch in London, the wreck of the SS Mendy in the English Channel, the Farfield Inn in Sheffield, and finally, Hillsborough Football Stadium in Sheffield. Thank you for joining us as we explore England's past and present through the places we have lost and sometimes sought to recover. It's been an interesting but very emotive category. Next time we'll be exploring a brand new category as we hear from Reverend David Ison's selections about your nominations in our Faith and Belief category. David will be revealing all, but perhaps you can guess which ones have made his top 10. Get in touch and tell us at hashtag 100 places. And whilst you're at it, please leave a review on iTunes. Thanks to my guests, historian Dan Cruikshank and Historic England's Emily G. I'm Susanna Lipscomb, and I hope you'll join me next time.
This is a Historic England podcast, sponsored by Ecclesiastical Insurance Group. When it feels irreplaceable, trust Ecclesiastical.